listener. Welcome to yet another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which Emma Burnell, say hello, Emma.
Hello.
Me, Steve Fielding. Usually just ourselves, but occasionally with a guest. And this week, or this month, it is John Elledge, who is assistant editor of the New Statesman. Say hello, John.
Hello, how are we doing?
We're all fine. Well, I'm fine. How are you, Emma?
I'm fine.
Great. Well, what we usually do is we talk about something in popular culture, a film, a TV show, or a series, and sort of kick it around, usually thinking about what it might say about politics. And we go in all kinds of different directions, hopefully, entertaining and informative ways. So this month, we've decided, or Emma decided, basically, very insistent.
My dictatorship.
Yes. We may be co-presenters, but really it is a Burnell dictatorship. Emma decided that we really had to talk about the BBC series Years and Years. Six-part dystopia, I think it might be described, although a dystopia with a happy ending of sorts, written by Russell T. Davis. Which concluded the other week, I think, because I've been watching it on iPlayer, so I'm a bit disconnected. So, Emma, you're the enthusiast for this one. John kind of talked his way onto this because I think he's got things he wants to say.
Well, he ranted on Twitter saying that he had thoughts, so I was like, well, come and share them with us.
I have many thoughts. I have so many thoughts.
It's always nice to have thoughts. So, Emma, why don't you just describe to us in as brief a way as possible, given it covers a lot of stuff, what actually is Years and Years about?
So Years and Years, the reason I wanted to cover it is because I've been walking with my sister a lot recently for reasons that I won't go into. But and you know, when you do go for long walks with somebody, you find out sort of what they're into. And it's very rare that my sister is the one who raises something political with me. And she, every time we went out, she's like, have you watched Years and Years yet? You've got to watch Years and Years. It's so good. It's so interesting. It's so important. Oh my God, you won't believe what's happened this week. And that really interested me because she never gets into a political drama. You know, I don't think she's watched any of the things that you and I would consider foundational. So the fact that she was so into it really interested me, and all her mates were watching it. They all went down the pub and talked about it almost as much as we all talked about Love Island. So I thought, wow, that's clearly got some cut through. So I watched it. It's about a family based in, I believe, Manchester, Steve, is that right?
Walton or Didsbury, and or Didsbury, because a lot of it was filmed just round the corner from where I live. Yes.
There you go. And each member of the family is in some ways an archetype. There is, you know, the gay one, the mixed marriage, the older matriarch, the lady in a wheelchair. They are not what you would actually, that they're a representative family only in that they represent absolutely everybody. But it starts off, you see them very briefly in the credits of a new year, and it's I think it's 10 years, starts 10 years in the future and then goes on to 2029. And what you're seeing is a near future rise of fascism, global fascism, and the various impacts that has on this family individually and the world as a whole. In the first episode, there's a nuclear incident between, I think it's the US and China.
Yes.
And one of the family members, who is the activist one,
Edith,
is there, and she witnesses it close enough to be given radiation poisoning and is sick throughout the show. So that's how it all kicks off. Mm. And through this, you see the rise of a Farage-style politician. I mean, you know, the thinly veiled sort of European style fascist. I mean, she's even running something called the Four Star Party. And so most of the story is centered on the impact of the family, on the family, of the political surroundings. But you also see the rise of this Vivian Rook, who is a very populist politician.
So it's kind of post Brexit. What it's basically what happens to Britain after Brexit and these Britons, and as you say, the kind of outside of the family, and they all. I mean, we can talk about the family. I think the family is awful. I mean, you say they're archetypes, and they are meant to represent Britain, aren't they? I mean, the name, the family name, the Lions with a Y. But they're lions. Yeah. There could be lions in another way. You know, I think it's as obvious as that. It's kind of like what happens to post-Brexit Britain and basically Nigel Farage in a skirt becomes prime minister in the end, does she not? Vivian Rook. And that's all part of the conspiracy, which is not quite clear who's behind her, but it's all corrupt and there's all kinds of things going on. And immigration, of course, and refugees feature quite large in all of that. So it's kind of also asking the question, isn't it, about how will we get there? Or almost really, how are we where we are now?
And it kind yeah. of, yeah, I think it is drama about where we are now and questioning which direction we're going in.
Yeah, because it is a dystopia. It's kind of, it's a BBC One dystopia, so it has a happy ending. But it is a dystopia in the classic sense that what he's doing is he's looking at what he thinks is going wrong now and then just projects forward. So although it's about the future, it's actually about the present, I think. So Jeremy, you've got thoughts about this is how you've kind of taught yourself onto this gig. Have you got anything you want to say about it in general terms so we can kick this off?
Yeah, so I had the exact opposite experience to Emma, which is, you know, Emma was saying how like loads of people she knows who aren't normally watching political dramas were really into this. My experience was loads of people I know who love political drama or who love the work of Russell T. Davis weren't watching this because they just couldn't cope. And just the idea of like spending every day worrying about fascism on top of, you know, watching the news and worrying about fascism was just too much. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a testament to quite what a good piece of drama it is for most of its length, that it doesn't feel that unlikely. Like it feels very close to where we are now, both in terms of like the technology stuff has got a lot of attention, lots of discussion of it being a bit like Black Mirror. The technology is all very, you know, plausible near future stuff for the most part, but actually the political stuff does often feel like it's an extension of where we are now, just that kind of sense of rolling crisis we've now had for 3 or 4 years, really. Just continuing that for another decade into the future and asking where it will take us. And I think it's an interesting piece of work from Russell T. Davis. The T doesn't stand for anything, by the way. It's my favourite Russell T. Davis fact.
Does it not?
No, it's just in there to distinguish him from the broadcaster and journalist Russell Davis.
So it's just Russell the Davis.
Basically, yeah, which is a very lovely Welsh name. But like politics, you know, big P politics is not really his thing. Like he's very into kind of, you know, character drama and these are the big emotional moments and so on. He's brilliant at it. But often when he's tried to do stuff like actively political, it gets a little bit lost. Like when he was running Doctor Who, there's a series of a political plot line to it where it becomes very, very clear very quickly. He has no idea how the British Constitution works.
Yeah.
On a fairly basic level. Like and like someone describes themselves as the president-elect of the United States, apparently not realizing that, you know, that means, you know, someone waiting to become US president having won an election rather than the person who actually is. There's just lots of stuff like that where like he clearly not great at politics. So it was interesting seeing him tackle something with such big political themes and really go for it, and it was, you know, a lot of it worked incredibly well. Like you said that Emma Thompson's character, Vivian Rook, is a bit like Nigel Farage. What she reminded me of to a slightly freakish degree, actually, was Claire Fox from The Institute of Ideas.
Yeah. I was thinking Katie Hopkins, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think all these people are sort of in the mix.
She's like an ITV2 Claire Fox.
I mean, I don't know whether you're being rude about Claire Fox or ITV2 there, to be honest. Yeah.
To be fair, I'm probably more likely to be rude about Claire Fox than I am about ITV2. I watch quite a lot of ITV2. But there is a certain type of celebrity that belongs on ITV2. You're Keith Lemon. You know, you're ex-Love Islander who's made it beyond a year. And that is, you know, that is very much what, a Claire Fox Vivian Rook mashup would be. I'm just thinking of that moment where she's dancing, you know, she's doing the whole populist TV show bit. She's dancing with one from Steps.
Mm. Obviously from Steps, was he?
Yes.
I thought I meant to know who he is, but I don't know who the hell he is. Yeah. Well, no, the Vivian Rook character is kind of interesting, but you can see it coming from a mile off. You know, when you see her in the first episode, you go, I think I know what's going to happen here. And it does. She becomes, you know, prime minister with her own party, populist parties with these bizarre policies. But, you know, she's very mumsy. She's very populist. She appeals to the sassy single mum, you know, so because she's meant to be the working class character. I mean, this is, if it can go back a bit to the family before we maybe go and talk about the actual politics of it and how likely it all is and how he explains it. The family is, you say the archetypes, and it's got this aspiration. He wants it to be a state of the nation drama. And the nation is obviously some kind of state. But it has this kind of bizarre setup where every sibling is an archetype. But they're so kind of, it's like political correctness gone banal. That they are like, there's the sassy single parent, because all single parents have got to be sassy in this kind of thing. And she happens to be in a wheelchair because he presumably thought the family was already too big, so she had to have something else about her. There's the gay saintly brother. There's the straight dad who's not very good. I mean, he's the one that sends the gay brothers.
Spoilers, hang on. We'll get to that.
Well, we do spoilers on the show, but yeah, let's do that further down the line.
Yeah, I think we need to talk about the refugee stuff separately. Not, like a whole Frederick.
Yeah, fair enough. But Stephen, who is the, you know, the white straight act, although he does have you know, he's married a black woman, so he can't be that bad. That's in the kind of the ethos of the series. That'll be him. But he's the only one that does something really bad. He's just a little bit rubbish. And then there's, of course, then there's Edith, who's the activist who doesn't appear to do anything apart from contract radiation poisoning. Her activism is a bit, we don't know what she really
did. To be fair, she does break into a lot of secret government facilities and actually facilitate the whole revolution.
Absolutely, during the of the thing. And then Grandma, who's this lovable, I mean, not at all racist. I mean, she's the most, you know, politically correct grandma you might have possibly found. I just thought, this is not...
So how does she not die? She's like 85 at the start of the series and she's still there at the end and not apparently... Like, I don't think she's nearly as frail as she should be at like 102 or something.
Well, yeah, it's like, oh, you've got... macular degeneration, and now you haven't. I was like, my poor old grandpa, who died at 93. He had macular degeneration for the last 5 years of his life, and it's a horrible thing. Yeah, and I was that storyline. I think because it touched me personally, was a bit ooh, I really hope they will cure macular degeneration that easily in the future. But it just felt like a bit of a brush off. Oh, we've got to give her something. She's old.
Yeah. But the grandma was kind of that, because the interesting thing was the parents of this family of these siblings are absent. I mean, the father leaves because he has an affair, or does he leave because his daughter, you know, recently born daughter, is it spina bifida she's got?
Mm-hmm.
And the mother, who seems to be a bit of a saint, but dies. So the grandma is kind of there. I don't know what generation she's kind of meant to represent, but she's. She's the wise old bird, isn't she? She's the one that has got. She's the commonsensical one. I mean, what I had a problem with the family was it was so badly, crudely drawn, and everyone was an archetype, and they weren't really characters. That's kind of my thing about all of that, and that meant I didn't really take it at all credible. It wasn't credible as a group to me. I can see why he did it. State of the nation, everyone's got to represent a type, but the types were so. It's like 1990s drama. You know, so if you've got a gay character, has to be a saint, right? That's it. So I just thought it was just very hackneyed in many ways.
I mean, I think the gay character was one of the more broadly drawn, to be honest. What was interesting was that he thought he was a saint, but the family thought he was annoying as fuck most of the time.
That's true. That did come out towards the end. Yeah, that did come out. Yeah.
But I mean,
the absence of parents, I thought, was interesting because it did mean there were no, like the main cast were sort of fairly explicitly meant to be born in the 1980s.
Yeah.
So the parents would be boomers and they were not there. So you kind of take out this entire thread of that sort of generational conflict, which is driving a lot of our politics at the moment.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a conscious choice, just, we don't want to look at that. Or whether that's a coincidence, but yeah, I thought it was an interesting choice.
No, I think you're right. It probably didn't want that to confuse what you wanted to say.
Interesting, because actually that is such a core part of what's going wrong, is that boomer generation.
But I think it might be useful to get Grandma in, because, I mean, to talk about the ethos and what he was trying to say, Grandma is the wise old bird who basically tells them what's what, doesn't she, towards the end. And because it must be about 2030 when she says this, because it's in the last episode when everything's gone to pot and they're all going, everything's so terrible. And she basically turns around to them and says, essentially, it's your fault.
But it still doesn't alter the fact that it's all your fault.
What is?
Everything.
Who?
All of you.
What do you mean?
The banks, the government, the recession, America, Mrs. Rourke. Every single thing that's gone wrong, it's your fault.
What did I do? Where's this come from?
I get blamed for an awful lot, but how am I responsible for the entire world?
Because we are, every single one of us. We can sit here all day blaming other people. We blame the economy, we blame Europe, the opposition, the weather. And then we blame these vast sweeping tides of history, you know, like they're out of our control, like we're so helpless and little and small. But it's still our fault. You know why? Is that £1 T-shirt? A T-shirt that costs £1. We can't resist it, every single one of us. We see a T-shirt that costs £1 and we think, oh, that's a bargain, I love that, and we buy it. Not for best, heaven forfend, but nice little T-shirt for the winter to go underneath, that'll do. And the shopkeeper gets 5 miserable pence for that T-shirt. And some little peasant in a field gets paid 0.01 pence. And we think that's fine, all of us. And we hand over our quid and we buy into that system for life. I saw it all going wrong when it began in the supermarkets, when they replaced all the women on the till with those automated checkouts.
No, that's not our fault. I hate those things. They always are.
Oh, standard.
They drive me mad.
Yes, but you didn't do anything, did you? 20 years ago, when they first popped up, did you walk out? Did you write letters of complaint? Did you shop elsewhere? No. You huffed and you puffed and you put up with it. And now all those women are gone. And we let it happen.
No, but we're still...
And I think we do like them, those checkouts. We want them. Because it means we can stroll through, pick up our shopping, and we don't have to look that woman in the eye. The woman who's paid less than us. She's gone. We got rid of her. Sacked. Well done. So, yes, it's our fault. This is the world we built. Congratulations. Cheers, all.
But what do you think of that as an explanation? Because, I mean, in the absence of the generational conflict, which is really interesting, that's something that isn't there, that you might expect a State of the Nation drama to have in there. Essentially, the argument is from Grandma that the reason why we're in the mess we're in 2030, but by implication now, is because you didn't do anything, right? And she uses the example of what did you do when they introduced all of those automated machines, in supermarkets, so you can just get your stuff out without actually having to look at someone at the counter. You did nothing. You did nothing. And why didn't you do it? And she kind of almost says, had you stopped that? Sounds like a bit Paul Mason, because Paul Mason has recently said, if we all stop using those things and go and get served by an actual human, we'd start the process of bringing down neoliberalism. That if only you'd done something, we wouldn't be here. But I don't know that really... And then, of course, they then do something, and then there's a revolution, everything changes.
Yeah, I mean, this coming back to my sort of Russell T. Davis doesn't really do politics thesis, this is the thing I found a little bit unconvincing about about the ending where they do something and they do manage to bring down fascism. And there's a thing at the end where it's like, oh, but you know, it's the threat is always there, and yeah, fair enough. But it's quite, everyone has the assumption is that everyone has agency. And there's kind of, and I think this is sort of a problem with like trying to dramatize these things. It's kind of, it's difficult to dramatize structural forces. And actually, it's not clear to me that, you know, if people have been quite Luddite about, you know, automatic tellers in Tesco's or cheap clothing from China or whatever, then we wouldn't be in trouble now. It would just be different, you know, like, you know, that that kind of technological progress has happened for 200 years and causes eruptions, but we move on. But it's not clear to me that like a few individuals going, oh, I don't like that very much, is going to change anything. In the same way, I don't think I just don't buy the idea that at the end where they sort of bring down the nasty regime by filming it on their camera phones and transmitting it to everyone. The assumption is, well, if only ordinary decent people could see what was really happening, this wouldn't be allowed. Well, we can see. We have a work example of this in the United States right now. And ordinary decent people do not give a crap.
It hasn't moved the needle at all. You know, we've seen children locked in cages and nothing. So the idea that adults locked in bigger cages is going to be the thing that's going to suddenly re-spark our humanity. Sadly, I wish it were true. Wish it were true, but it's not true. And yeah, for me, it tied itself up too neatly in a bow, and there was no need to do that, really. And I think this is partly Russell T. Davis's has to have a happy ending problem. Like everything, I don't think I've ever seen Russell T. Davis leave anything not having a really neatly tied up happy ending. Thinking of the way that David Tennant left Who, and even the end of Queer as Folk or something, you know, it's always a happy ending. But I thought the political themes were really interesting. There was definitely a thing missing about the intergenerational conflicts. And the idea that the problem is not structural capitalism, but individual consumerism that allows structural capitalism was an interesting place to explore, but didn't really get explored throughout the rest of the show. So I thought, you know, I'd be interested to see that explored a little further. But you needed to get there earlier rather than simply have the more kind of we fall for showbiz charlatans, which was actually the political line. You know, the reason that the sassy single mother liked and voted for Vivian Rook wasn't because she was buying from Primark and wanted cheap burgers. It was because she fell for the charisma aspects. And I thought the charisma aspect was actually quite well explored, but could have been taken through to the end line. I felt like the it's your fault because consumerism was a bit of a sharp right turn.
Yeah. I mean, and also the thing that was missing, and it is down to that missing generation, is the implication was that we're all decent people. And it's only because we don't really know, or we don't think through the implications, that this is why we're in the mess that we're in. And once we know, then everything's going to be reset back to the good old days, whatever they happen to be. But there was no actual character who, and there were a lot of people, I mean, let's say 25% of the British population, who do want this thing. Yeah, they know. They don't, you know, they actively want whatever it is that Russell Davis is saying this is a problem. And they weren't in it. I mean, there was a few nasty characters, but they were very, you know, right on the margins, and they weren't part of the family.
I think each member of the family, in a way, displayed some of those some of those attitudes. So, for example, there was some anti-immigration sentiment as such, but so blame the stranger aspect. There was a, you know, from some of them, there was a blow it all up, you know, fuck the system aspect. There was a, you know, let's just go for the charismatic leader aspect. So I think in each of them, they all displayed a little bit of that. Yeah. So I'm not sure that's an entirely fair criticism.
But there wasn't a character who symbolised that way of thinking. And that's partly because
But I think that's a deliberate choice, though. I think the point is it's in all of us a little bit.
Ah, right.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think, like, it was fairly sort of explicit that no, we are all complicit in this in some way, and good people can do bad things and so on. Can we talk about the refugee stuff? Because I think that was by far the most effective thread. So one of the major subplots is the Russell Tovey character Daniel leaves his boyfriend, husband, one of the two, husband. So he, for this Ukrainian guy, he meets in a refugee housing in Manchester. And then he keeps getting deported. He spends like several episodes trying to get him back into the country. And they get as far as Spain, and there's a revolution, so they have to get out of Spain. And he makes it as far as France. And the only way of getting back into the UK, they get the passports, Nick. The only way of getting back into the UK is coming by, you know, one of those refugee boats of the sort we see in the Med rather a lot at the moment. And Daniel refuses to leave him. He says, no, I could, because he could go to the embassy, but he says, no, I'm coming with you. And we get these flashes of them in this massively overcrowded boat, and then it just cuts to him dead on the beach somewhere on the south coast. And that is quite genuinely like one of the most powerful bits of sequences in any drama I've ever seen. I was entirely unconsciously started weeping halfway through that and didn't realize that it's so overblown by the emotion of it. And I mean, it's a very effective way of dramatizing it, because like all the way through, you're kind of, you know, something terrible is going to happen, but you probably think that like Victor's not going to make it. It doesn't really like occur to you that one of the lead characters is going to die in a migrant boat somewhere in the English Channel. But it's a very effective way of sort of extending the circle of sympathy of like, you know, it forces you to imagine yourself or someone you love in that situation rather than just seeing them, you know, seeing refugees as some other character, some other category. And I thought that was incredibly powerful. And in a way that like, so I was slightly more annoyed by the ending not really delivering on the promise of that, of that kind of power, really.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The ending for me wasn't the strongest bit. That was probably the strongest. The way that was filmed just put you so in there that I was at once both emotionally moved, but also really my heart was racing. I was frightened. It was done that well, and it was, you know, it was genuinely. It didn't pull its punches, which. Actually, you kind of normally expect Russell Davies to do. I'm not Russell Tovey's biggest fan. That is how you say his name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Russell Davies is his biggest fan. He puts him in everything. but actually, he was a good choice to play this character. And the character himself was clearly conflicted about some things. One of the things I noticed when they had the election, I paid very careful attention who voted what, and he voted Tory, which I thought was a really interesting choice for a guy whose job was working as kind of social work with asylum seekers.
I thought he voted Labour.
No. The nasty older brother voted Labour.
Yeah.
And Celeste, the black wife of the errant Stephen, she voted Tory as well.
She did, yeah. Well, so they were split. They were always going to vote something different. They were clearly not getting on.
Yes. So yeah. I mean, it wasn't a terrible series. It was very uneven, and I thought, yeah, the refugees thread, and particularly that moment, which maybe says more about the director than about the writer, because the way it just went black at various points, didn't it? I mean, that was. There's nothing more effective than a blank screen. Yeah. Really, sometimes.
Particularly on primetime TV. It's just not something you see very often.
Yes, it's like breaking the fourth wall. I kind of wondered, because the political correctness angle, though, it's sort of banal. It's not got anything wrong with having certain kinds of people represented in a positive way. It's just the kind of unremittingness of it that I picked up from this in particular. I just wondered if you were trying to be more, like you're saying, your sister and all of her friends were talking about it. But if you wanted to talk to the people who actually are really the people that you might want to get to think about some of the issues, which might be some of that generation, the missing generation, and the people who might have some kind of questions about immigration and, you know, alternative lifestyles as they might see it. I just wondered. Because I don't think it was talking to those people. I think it was talking to already well-intentioned people, you know, progressive with a small p kinds of people. It wasn't addressing an audience that might consider voting for the Brexit Party, for example. I mean, I'm not sure what you could say to them, but I didn't see an in for those people in this. And having a gay refugee, I thought, why not have a Christian refugee, or, you know, a different kind of refugee? But
he could have been a Christian and a gay, you know, Steve.
Of course, and that would have been absolutely. There's no boundary thing there. So he could have been a Christian and a gay refugee. But nonetheless, I just thought
it's about expanding that circle of sympathy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's about humanising people that sometimes, in the pages of our beloved tabloid press, are dehumanised slightly.
Yeah, and I don't think this was about changing the minds of Brexit voters, but I think it was more about triggering, you know, that wake up bit at the end, that speech that we've sort of already talked about. Actually, that was aimed at the people who do care but don't really. Haven't been activated. You know, they sort of vaguely care and they hate seeing stuff on the news, but they haven't yet taken further action. They haven't been spurred. And that is why I found it so interesting that my sister was moved by this, because that's exactly the category that I would put her in. Yeah. You know, she and I probably have very similar beliefs. We certainly had the same upbringing. But I went off and became very, very political. She has she probably makes more difference in the world. Let's face it, she's an estate manager in social housing. She does stuff every day that I sort of just talk about. But, you know, in terms of political activism, she's never really been that activated. And I think that's the group of people this drama was speaking to.
I looked very briefly at the comments on the Internet Movie Database. And almost, well, actually universally for the ones I saw, they were all saying exactly what you're saying. Emma, which is, it's talking about this is really interesting, blah, blah, blah. But then I looked at the BRB figures for the series, and I couldn't find them because it didn't feature in the BBC's top 15. So that meant that less than 3.5 million people would have watched it. So I don't know what exact number it was. So it's reaching a lot of people. I mean, even if it was just 3 million people, and maybe of those people that are seeing it, they're all thinking very positive things.
I think, before we wrap up, we should probably talk about Vivian Rook a little more, because I thought she was, her ending was in particular like, oh my God, there's season two. Now, apparently Russell T. Davis has said he's never going to make season two. Yeah. But my God, what a story there is there.
Well, I must admit, I've got a thing about Emma Thompson. I really can't stand Emma Thompson.
Oh my God, how dare you?
Oh,
Emma Thompson is our national treasure.
No, she's not. And so when I first saw she was in it, I thought, oh God, Emma bloody Thompson. But she actually was very good. I mean, I don't know whether it's because I find her quite, you know, it's a certain, but I think she was very good as that character. She fitted the character very well. And she did that kind of mumsy, you know, as you were saying, ITV2, you know, B, C-list celebrity kind of shtick very well. But then towards the very end, the last episode or two, then she's revealed her this kind of, Not exactly hard-faced, but deeply cynical figure. But we never really know anything about her, do we?
But that's the point, isn't it? That you all see for the first four episodes that her TV persona, you only ever see her really through that very public persona. And it's only in episode five where you see her behind closed doors. Mm. And, you know, we could be talking about Farage. We could be talking about Boris Johnson. You know, these people who are just so different to the persona that they adopt in public.
But were we surprised by that, you know, watching John? Were you surprised that she turned out to be at the head of some, or at least, because she referred to some kind of people that, I've got to do this, and if I don't, kill me.
Yeah, no, I kind of thought that's sort of the same problem as we were talking about with the ending, like the idea of agency. Mm-hmm. It's this assumption that there is somebody somewhere pulling the strings.
Yeah.
Because if you're writing a drama, that you need an enemy of the face, basically. That's kind of much easier to dramatize. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think sometimes there are just structural forces. Mm-hmm. Like if you kind of look at Nigel Farage, I think he does. He certainly has some very rich friends, but I think he does what he does partly because he's a rampant self-promoter and it's been good for his career to get this kind of platform, and partly because he genuinely believes in certain things. It is not some kind of act he is putting on to be the sort of puppet for sort of shadowy forces somewhere out of sight. But, you know, it makes for a sort of more dramatic ending to go, oh, well, there's something else behind her. Whereas actually, I think a lot of the time there isn't. There's just kind of people acting in their own short-term interests.
I mean, I thought it was ironic that, I mean, one of the ills of our politics today is the belief in conspiracies, right? And that's what, and yet this kind of explains the rise of Vivian Rook and how she becomes what she becomes through a conspiracy. So it kind of almost confirms one of the ills when it's trying to address those ills and make us all better. I thought that was also a very weak dramatic out as well. It was.
I agree about the conspiracy theory stuff, and I agree about the structural stuff. I don't know how you do that in a drama, particularly. I just really want to see season two that is basically a remake of The Prisoner with Vivian Rook as number six.
Just watch The Prisoner. You know, you might have watched The Prisoner, actually. You'd probably be better off.
Can I just make one more point?
Absolutely.
In the final episode, when everything is like properly descending into full-on fascism, one of the things that the writer throws in as, you know, a sign that we are now in a truly horrible world is that the government closes the BBC. And that's meant to be like one of the most frightening things imaginable. Which, you know, from the point of view of one of our leading TV writers, I can totally understand that. But I just thought it was very funny that this is kind of the ultimate crime as far as Russell T. Davies is concerned.
I mean, I'm a big BBC defender, but yeah, that was a little clunky.
Yeah. I think the camps are worse than the closing of the license fee, to be honest with you, mate.
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe as a final bombshell, I was very confused by nobody aged. So you got all these BBC presenters, and they're all in 2030. They look exactly like they do now.
Well, if they can cure macular degeneration in the heartbeat, maybe that's they've cured aging.
Yeah, it's just some other technology is not shown. Yeah.
Right, fair enough. Right. Well, on that very speculative note, I think we might want to draw this to a conclusion. Emma wants to have a season two. I'm dubious about season one. And John, your thoughts seem to be more ambiguous.
I thought it was fantastic, and then got annoyed at the last episode because it just kind of wussed out and said, like, no, we just need to rise up. It's like, I don't think the world works like that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's Russell T. Davies' problem, isn't it? But yeah, it doesn't need a follow-up. I just really want, as I say, a Prisoner remake with Vivian Rook at the centre of it. I just think that'd be amazing.
So that brings us to an end of this episode of The Zeitgeist Tapes. And I need to thank Lord Stuart Wood for our theme tune, to remind you that this is a political human production, and to beg you, dear listener, to rate and review us on whatever platform you are listening to this episode.